The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private. Trust Ireland's leading private hospitals with locations nationwide, including Dublin, Cork and Limerick.
This is News Talk.
In 1970, my next guest was the first woman to become a DJ on BBC Radio 1. She has seen the music industry evolve from the ground zero moment of punk and the epiphanies that arrived in the late 80s with the acid house movement and the second summer of love. She's now BBC Radio 1's longest serving DJ, still hosts her own late night show. And to celebrate her career, she's penned a new book called Hey, Hi, Hello. And all of this while celebrating her 80th birthday this year. Annie Nightingale, good morning and welcome to our programme.
Good morning to you. Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Now, we're going back a long way to when you became the first female DJ ever to get a job on BBC Radio 1.
Yeah.
Were you seen as simply a token at the time?
Well, that's a very interesting question. They had made a really definite decision that there would be no women DJs, which I was quite shocked about because I'd worked in TV presenting, writing for magazines, newspaper. I hadn't experienced anything that any sort of sexism like that. And I was just perplexed. And so when they went, no, no, you can't join us because you're a woman. So I say, what's that got to do with it? And they went, because there are DJs, a husband substitute. And that was their phrase. I think they thought that, and they had the kind of still quite a probably late 1950s attitude, the management, the first management team who took over Radio 1, who were quite technical guys. And I think they saw it as a very techy job. And they actually say to me, why would a woman want to be a DJ? I say, because it's the best job in the world. And so it took me 3 years to persuade them. And then I think there was a lot of public pressure by then, actually stoked by me. There was a growing feminism movement. And so I think they thought, oh, well, we'll have to take on one. So to answer your question, yeah, probably there was an element of tokenism. And in fact, there wasn't another female DJ on Radio 1 for another 12 years. So maybe you're right.
Could you describe the BBC of the time? Because I have this vision of, you know, post-war corridors and green bays and, you know, elderly machinery and all of that, you know, almost relics of World War II.
I've grown up listening to the BBC as a child all the way through my life. And I actually went to college on the same street where it is, on Regent Street. And I looked at this big hulking building and I never, ever imagined I worked there. And they always seemed very remote, very posh. All the women who worked there, the producers, had, you know, very double-barrel names. So I thought, I never imagined it would be for me. It felt very austere. And you imagine these announcers literally wearing dinner suits going, good evening, here's the news. And so it felt very formal. I didn't feel like knock and roll me at all until obviously the pirate ships happened and then when they got closed down and Radio 1 had to happen and the BBC had to take it on. You know, I don't know whether they even wanted it at the beginning. Actually, that first run of DJs, they had the most huge listening figures. They had 28 million. Impossible to think of that. No TV programme gets that kind of thing nowadays. So they built this station with a massive audience built on the DJ names. And they became household names in a way that's not happening in any other country. You know, the late Terry Wogan, who I absolutely adored, you know, he was on Radio 1 and Radio 2, but he helped to build that.
I suppose another Irishman was involved as well, and you met him, Ronan O'Reilly, who died not so long ago.
Ronan O'Reilly, what a character. So he had this idea of, he was promoting, I think he was a manager of Georgie Fame, and he wanted to promote him more on radio, so decided to start this pirate ship called Radio Caroline. And I met him through his publicist in London. And it seemed the craziest idea, but it worked. And it was actually a great moment for me because I lived in Brighton at the time on the seafront. So I'd be listening to Radio Caroline and they go, and they were moving their base and they were going past on the English Channel. They were going past my window. I lived on the seafront, and they were going, "Hello, we can see you, Brighton." And I thought the romance of it was so exciting. I thought, this is what I want to do. And if I could have jumped in the sea and swam out and joined them, I kind of would have done. And that was the moment when I realised what I really wanted to do was play music on the radio. And the sort of music they were playing, which is not being played by the BBC, it was a very rich period. This is like mid-60s. You know, we had Motown, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. I mean, in the book, I quote one top 10 from, I think, 1966. You would know every artist to this day. I mean, I don't look back now. I'm always playing new music. But the importance of that era, and I think, you know, Ronan O'Reilly did a huge job, because then there were Radio London and all the other pirate ships. And that changed music.
Even when you did join the BBC, it turned out that there were still some rules. I mean, for example, and this I find astonishing, they couldn't play back-to-back hits.
No. Well, that was because agreement with various unions, etc. The agreement was they couldn't just play records or, you know, commercial music all day long. So they had to have, the bands had to come in and try and play as well as they had on their records, and then perform them live, and they had to go to auditions to do that. I think the Rolling Stones failed once or even twice. The Beatles failed as well. It was a difficult loophole. So whereas the pirates were illegal, so they could do what they liked, the BBC could not do that. So to be fair to them, it wasn't really their fault that they were not allowed to play the actual, what we really want to hear, the properly made records.
Now, you suggest in your book that the DJs employed by the BBC might have been vetted by MI5.
Well, I was told we all were. I was told that there was a little room somewhere in Broadcasting House, and I should go up and down the corridors. I was thinking, I wonder if this is where they are, you know, MI5 room. And we never did discover, but apparently we were all vetted. But it's quite intriguing to think, though, that that was happening.
I suppose if you think of the Cold War and the fact that someone on radio could be broadcasting state secrets in code via the radio.
I certainly didn't know any.
When you joined the BBC, you were already well got with the Beatles.
Yeah, they were great for me. And I keep saying this, that the debt that my generation owes to them, they opened the doors, they gave us inspiration, they made us believe that, you know, follow your dream and it can come true. And that, I think, that was important. I mean, apart from the fantastic music, but that was the inspiration they gave to young people. And I still feel we owe them so much for that.
Now, do you have a view as to what broke up the Beatles? Alan Klein, or was it Yoko Ono, or was it fragmenting in any event?
I think it was a bit of everything. And I think George Harrison really put it best. He said, look, we've been together. He said he was 16, 15. He wanted to spread his wings. He wanted to do different things that he couldn't do within that format. They all went their different ways. I think they've been together. We forget how long they've been together. Plus, Brian Epstein dying was a very, very big and terrible event for them. And then the Alan Klein business that happened. Yoko got the blame for it. I mean, she used to sit in the studio with them, which they were not used to having anybody else doing that. It was a combination of all those things. I often wonder, I think, if there were no Beatles, and Paul has pointed out that they were the first year that didn't do national service. Now, he said, if we'd had to do national service, we would have all been separated, all around the UK, and we would never have met. So there wouldn't have been any Beatles. But I often wonder how they would have got on individually if they'd never met. I think Paul would have been a very successful songwriter, because he just got that ability to write a lot of fantastic songs. I think John would have been successful, but they wouldn't have been the Mop Tops. George, a very talented musician, but he liked being in the band. He wasn't really a front man. Ringo, everyone loved Ringo, but it was the four of them together. That was the magic.
Do you remember where you were when you heard that John Lennon had been killed, had been murdered?
Yeah, very much so. We had planned to go to New York 2 days after that to interview him for that album, Double Fantasy. What happened was my daughter, who was then quite small, came and woke me up in the morning and said, Richard Skinner from Radio 1 is on the phone and said, have you got Paul McCartney's own number? And that's how I found out. And that night, I was doing a show called The Old Grey Whistle Test at the time. So we put on a live tribute to him, and we got together people that we could. Most people were so shocked and horrified, they couldn't even come to the studio to take part in this discussion. And in the middle of it, while we were running a videotape of a previous interview, the producer, Mike Appleton, came in to me in the studio and said, Paul wants to speak to you. It sounds ridiculous, but I had no idea what he was talking about. It was a live program. It's pretty stressful. I thought, what do you mean, Paul? Paul who? You know, on the phone in the middle of a live program. And it was Paul McCartney. So I went to the phone and he said, just say thank you on behalf of myself and Ringo and George and Yoko and Linda. And I suddenly thought, that's when it hit me. That's only three Beatles left. It was a very moving moment. And, you know, I thought, go back to the front of the camera and hold this together, because everyone is feeling the same. Everyone is very shocked. We thought, why? Why did anyone want to do that to him? And what had happened, nobody really knew much at that point, because it's only, you know, the very next day that we did this program. But it's funny because a lot of people seem to remember that moment.
Now, a while ago, you referenced that chart that you reproduced in the book from May of 1966. And it's very interesting. Painted Black, The Rolling Stones, Wild Thing, The Troggs,
yep.
Strangers in the Night, Frank Sinatra, Pretty Flamingo, Manfred Mann, Sorrow, The Merseybeats, Sloop John B, The Beach Boys, Shotgun Wedding by Roy C, Monday Monday, The Mamas and the Papas, Rainy Day Women, numbers 12 and 35 from Bob Dylan, and Hey Girl, The Small Faces.
I think, you know, a lot of credit for that goes to the Pirate Ships, who were playing all of that music. And there was a producer who became my producer, eventually called Bernie Andrews, who produced Saturday Club on the BBC Light programme before Radio 1. He then went on to be a Radio 1 producer. He was the only one who really was committed to playing the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix and Pink Floyd. And he would put them for double sessions so that they could get it right. And he was a huge help. He's no longer with us, but, you know, he helped me incredibly, as well as he was John Peel's producer too. So there are people behind the scenes.
Your book is a catalogue of big names, people that you met, and sometimes in passing, like Tony Blair, but others like Dusty Springfield you knew well,
yeah.
David Bowie. I mean, you predicted that he would be the next big thing after the Beatles, even when he was a skinny, oddly dressed fellow who had visions of ripping up the pavement in the street where he had his art centre and putting down pink paving stones.
Pink and blue paving stones, yeah. I don't know if he ever got around to doing that, but you see, the thing was that when the Beatles were obviously going to break up, we could feel it coming. There were a lot of paper in the cracks that went on at Apple, but it was clear that all these directions that I've been talking about, were, you know, they were going different directions. Everyone was looking for what is going to be the new band, the new group to take over from them. And once I heard Space Oddity, and I'd been aware of other David Bowie's, I thought, it's him. It's not a band. It's this one guy. Because he had that vision. I mean, Space Oddity was about guy in space. It wasn't a love song. And, you know, I could see the vision. And the way that was recorded with a Mellotron and this thing called a Stylophone. So he was using electronic experimental influences in an experimental song. And that, I thought, yeah, that's the way forward.
Now, your book spans so many artists, Mark Bolan, so many more, all the people you met. But right up to date, at the end of the book, there's a chapter, Meet the O'Connells, Maggie, yeah. Phineas and Billie Eilish.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Once in a generation talent. They've got Irish roots, you know. And obviously the name out Phineas O'Connell. I believe that Eilish is a Gaelic version of Elizabeth. Have you ever heard that?
That's right. Yes, indeed.
Oh, it is. Oh, good. Well, I put that in the book. Yeah, I cannot wait to see where they go next. She's still only 18. And, you know, they've done the Bond movie theme. They appear at the Oscars. They've won everything they can win. I mean, she should have been on tour here through this summer, but obviously that's cancelled like everything else. Mm. So I'm fascinated to know where they will take that talent.